What's left, episode 3. No, Javan today's on holiday in Sri Lanka. Big ups, Javan, he's with the elephants. But I'm joined by two of my absolute favourite journalists, James Bloodworth, and I'm with Matt Shea. Thank you very much for coming on, boys.
Thanks for having me, first of all. I'm a journalist, mainly investigative journalist. I've just done a book on the Manosphere called Lost Boys.
There you go, up there. Sorry, Matt, I didn't get your book up here. Apologies.
Available in all good bookshops.
And the bad ones.
And bad ones, yeah. I'm not fussy because I still get paid. Yeah, I did a book before on Amazon called Hired, which was like undercover at Amazon. And the Manosphere I investigated since like 2018, 19, really, with the book.
I've been making documentaries for Vice, BBC, Channel 4, focusing on crime, politics, the far right. I've also recently written a book with Jamie Tosin, called Clown World, 4 years inside Andrew Tate's Manosphere, also available in most good bookshops. And yeah, also made two documentaries about Andrew Tate. And
the documentaries, yeah, I'll add.
You could say, yeah, we were the first ones to kind of interview his alleged victims. And, you know, I embedded with him for a few weeks in Romania, was initiated into his masculinity cult, The War Room, which is as cringe as it sounds. And was punched in the face by him.
That was that's how your book begins, right? With you getting crashed in the face.
Yeah. Always have to start in the action.
But that's actually a good place to start. So like James, you've just done 5 years undercover, more or less, in the Manosphere. What is the strangest thing you had to do? Like when you were doing it, you're like, fuck me, I'm really living my journalism right now.
Part of this boot camp thing and the Men of Action program in Vegas, similar to the War Room in some ways, like minus the fighting. So there was times when we were out in the desert on these photo shoots with all these hired like Lamborghinis and stuff. And there's this like procession of guys posing in front of the Lambo or going climbing up on some rocks. And it was just a weird situation. And also rented mansions in front of like infinity pools. And that was kind of a really weird experience. And also taking those guys out to nightclubs, like shepherding them into nightclubs, because a lot of those people had never been to a club before. And it was very like socially awkward guys, and kind of managing them while they went out. That was kind of how I got to hang around with some of those guys.
I mean, from a journalist perspective, I think I'd much rather choose James's experience of like seeing my
photo. I even got my own photo.
I've seen the photo of you. It's very Tate-like. You know the like Tate Bugatti photo, like where he's in the desert and he's got the like he's doing the thing to like flex his pecs.
I was flexing.
Yeah. Was there a little bit of you that when you were doing it, you're like, this actually is kind of fun, or were you always like, this is a fucking joke?
No, it was fun because it was also like almost like a form of character acting to a point. So like that stuff is, there was parts of that experience undercover and embedded with those groups where I kind of have this anxiety because I'm not being myself fully. Like I am a bit, but I still have to kind of converse with these people and I can't just kind of let rip what I really think of it. But stuff like the photo shoots and that were kind of, I saw it as kind of silly and it was sort of fun. And it was always kind of ironically, looking at it kind of ironically, I suppose.
And occupying the mindset of these guys, right? So you're trying to play up to their personas, their characters that they've also put on at the door, right? Because they're trying to ape Tate and all of these other people that you're seeing on screen.
It's all a costume. It's right. All a performance. So they're performing. They're performing this idea of masculinity. They think they have to perform, because otherwise they're going to be like surplus men, as was the phraseology that was used on this course, or incels, or like they feel like they have to perform this role. And so for me, it's kind of, I'm just putting on the costume for an afternoon.
But that is the greatest irony with the Manosphere, is it is all projection. And the one thing that truly masculine men do, whatever masculinity actually means, is they don't harp on constantly about being masculine. The second someone starts trying to project masculinity, it's cringe, right? It's so obvious. We've all done it, especially when we're younger. We've all at some point felt insecure in our masculinity and then done something to seem more masculine to girls or to other guys or whatever. Yeah. It's so cringe when
it's
you do that.
It's a performance, right?
It's a performance. It's a projection. The Manosphere is all about projection. And like, obviously, if there is any kind of masculinity, and we can spend ages trying to find what that is, it's certainly not people talking about being masculine, right? It's like you just have that confidence and you just kind of carry yourself confidently. And that's why with Andrew Tate, it was such a caricature of that performance, both him and the men around him. I mean, when I went to Romania to embed in the War Room, I'm surrounded by all these men who have come to learn to be masculine, right? To learn how to talk to women, to learn how to carry themselves, to learn how to shake a hand in a masculine way, to learn how to like walk in a masculine way. They're being trained by generals who have names like Alpha Wolf.
And Sartorial Shooter.
Yeah, and this isn't a joke. Like, this is actually how they refer to themselves, right? Like, and I'm thinking, and they all saw
it's
me.
Gamer tags, bro. Their yeah. gamer tags yeah. is real names.
Exactly. And they all saw me as like kind of slightly feminine and like a beta male or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, I was thinking like, if I brought any one of you to the pub with like my brothers or my friends, they would rip the piss out of you constantly. Yeah, like yeah, you guys yeah. are ridiculous.
Moist.
But Andrew Tate, he's almost the ultimate caricature of that, right? And when I remember there was one point when I saw Andrew and his brother walking to the courtroom to face to face their indictment for sex trafficking. And they were wearing like their classic skin tight like shirts with the buttons undone with their like, yeah, you know, yeah. wax chest. And smoking cigars and like pushing reporters out of the way as they walk towards the court to face like sex trafficking allegations. And I remember looking at them and thinking like, I have often felt insecure about my masculinity, but actually like,
not right now.
I'm all right. Like if all it is just like a projection.
Bro, have you ever gone to a suit shop and been like, I'm definitely not getting the most skin tight suit, like the one that's basically like, what is it, a base layer? Like, I'm not going to be wearing that
exactly,
one.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's the one that he loves. That's the one that he picks first, right? I think it's yeah. so revealing. I mean, you were saying earlier off camera, James, that you'd credited Matt for something in your book. What is that thing that you'd credited him for?
I reviewed Matt's book. It was really good. And there was a scene in it where. So Andrew Tate and is kind of adjacent to something called hustle culture, which is this idea that you should be super productive all the time. You should always be working. Basically, that if you're not a six-figure entrepreneur by the time you're 25, you failed at life and you should kill yourself. That's the kind of gist of it.
You definitely should if you failed.
Caricaturing it slightly, but there's a scene in the book where like, Andrew Tate is very much preaching this message. You know, if I'm not working, I'm sleeping. I think he said yeah. somewhere. Matt and Jamie write that. Tate, you know, most of the time they spent with him in his compound, he seemed to be like sitting around the pool chatting shit with his brother, smoking cigars. So it's kind of, yeah, it's all presentation. And a lot of the influencers I met in the manosphere, and Tate is kind of the poster boy of this stuff, is they kind of beguile people with this lifestyle. And video-based social media has allowed them to do that in the way, like in the past, these guys would be in the back pages of like a men's magazine or selling their magic beans in the back of like a porno mag or something. Mm. And because of social media, they can kind of, you know, they have that telegenic charisma very often, you know, bamboozle the person with this kind of big personality. Mm. But also it's always against this backdrop of this kind of ostentatious, the teenage boy fantasy, like Dan Bilzerian was the
mm. He when I was 14, it was all Dan Bilzerian.
Yeah.
So like when Tate came along, I was like, I've seen this shit before. Like, I have really understood. I know what this is.
It really is really useful. Like, they make you feel like you're missing something because you're not, like, they possess something you don't. They make you feel like everyone's having more sex than you. Everyone's on a nicer holiday, eating nicer food in a private jet or whatever. But then they also use that as part of the sales funnel to then come in and say, you know, this is how the world's changing. Elite, high-status men like me have all this stuff. We're kind of hoarding all the treasure. And if you don't buy my course... you're going to be a brokey soy boy.
That was your experience of it, wasn't it? Like the private jet still being on the runway, taking the photo shoot sort of vibe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all these people are renting private jets. I don't think Tate owns a private jet.
He's
because he was very
it.
Difficult for him to get one for us when he said he would.
Oh, but really?
Yeah. And I don't even know if he has always really owned all of the cars that are in his Instagram.
They're leased, aren't they? I mean, for a company or something. I saw some
potentially. But a lot of the Manosphere influencers are the same. You know, they rent the Rolex, they rent the Bugatti, they rent the women. They're paying them to be there. It's all to create this image for Instagram, as you said, of look how masculine I am. And some people see that and it makes them jealous. And they think, why don't I have that? Like, no one wants to have sex with me. I don't have a fancy car. Mm. What am I doing wrong?
Mm.
And it's those vulnerable men who then feel they need to double down.
This is what kind of confuses me, right? Because on one level, every guy I know, like, I guess I'm not the target audience for Tate stuff. I'm 24, but let's say three, four years ago, all my mates would say, Instagram does not make me happier. And like, I know that this isn't a real representation of life, like what I'm seeing online on people's stories or whatever. In the same way that I'm going to put my story on the highlights and the good experiences, I'm not going to show off like when I'm, you know, clipping my toenails or whatever. So when it's we're existing in this like bad faith world where we know that it's artificial and we know it's constructed, and yet we still experience it as if it were real.
Yeah, I think though that is partly an age thing as well, because I've met people like 13, 14 who've been like sucked into this world, and you don't have like media literacy. Well, I don't feel like I had media literacy 24, 25, but especially like 13, 14, you don't have like the media literacy to distinguish between this is fake and this is real. Especially again, when you have like this big personality that's circumventing socialization from like parents or teachers and just going straight to a kid's bedroom on the phone or something. Yeah. And it's someone who's cooler than the male role models in your life, at least like on a superficial level, like muscly, does a combat sport, rich, versus like your dad, who's maybe like, you know, just doing a kind of ordinary job or whatever, or ordinary job. It's not so glamorous.
Pints on the Sunday.
Yeah, yeah. The belly, paunch, yeah, well upholstered.
Hey, that's where I'm trying to get to one day, you know, inshallah. The media often, I think, gets really obsessed with this question around like, why is it that young men are turning to this? Like, what is it that they're missing out on? What is it that they're attracted to? I had my TV debut this year where I was on Good Morning Britain, and they wanted to ask me that very same question. And to be honest, I went quite soft with the answer in a way. Like, I just said it's a point about shame more broadly. Young people feel shamed. Young men feel shamed about, you know, what they want and what they need and what they care about and what they like. And then you have a character, right, who basically says, whatever your basic carnal desires as a teenage boy are the only things that matter to be a man and in life. And so they just give them and put it on steroids, right? It's like GTA. Like, that's the thing that they always talk about, is this like custom-made reality sort of thing. And like, that is something that you as a kid would think, well, that's what being an adult is, doing whatever the hell I want.
It's all like ego and impulse.
Exactly. And I guess that's the reason why people are attracted to it, that we don't ever really want to get into, is that when you're a teenage boy, the thing that you're attracted to is the thing that people say, don't look at that. Like, don't watch that. That's your parents are going to be annoyed at you if you look at that. It's like we're moths to the flame.
Yeah. But also, I don't think most young men get involved in Andrew Tate or the Manosphere because they're misogynist and they hate women.
Definitely not.
I don't think they arrive at these positions through some sort of like political ideology. Yeah, but it's like they want to be rich, they want to get laid, and they want fancy cars, and they also probably want to be stronger and be able to beat other boys up. And that is
think it's more that.
That is not a new thing. Yeah. That is like a reality of being a young man or boy. That has always been there, right? Most young men that I've spoken to who got into Andrew Tate, they're not like, oh yeah, I hate women, I found someone who also hates women, great. They're like, you know, the thing that Andrew Tate says to me is like, stop smoking weed and playing video games. If you want a life like me, you want a car like me, you want women like me, then you got to hustle and do all this shit. Well, you have to buy my course, right?
Yeah, buy my course.
And make me rich, which ironically is how I have the cars. Yeah. And that is the emptiness at the center of it. It's all a money-making scheme. But the appeal of it is it's appealing to the thing that's always been there in young.
That was my complete experience of it as well. Like, anytime I spoke to a Tate fan, it was that this guy is rich. I want to be rich. I'm definitely not rich. I don't know a way to make money, and he's going to teach me how to do it. He's like he's my guru.
Jordan Peterson as well. So Peterson, he has this aspect of his initial appeal, at least. There's this very meritocratic aspect to it where, and it's also a countercultural message where we live in a culture where it's very much like instant gratification. If it feels good, you should, I was going to say do it, but it's really, if it feels good, consume it, like buy the product that will fix your thing, consume pornography, play computer games, whatever. If it feels good, good emotions are the kind of thing that should be at the forefront. Whereas Peterson comes along and he's like, no, you have to do the thing that actually hurts, that's painful. Go to the gym, you know, stand up straight, put yourself out there.
Yeah,
that's kind of good.
That is good advice.
But it's countercultural in some ways. And that's kind of, for some people who've never had that kind of tough love message, it can seem like a revelation, even though it's so straightforward. Because then you do the thing. You maybe go to the gym, like do a bench press or whatever for the first time, and it fucking hurts. But then you get that weird sense of deep satisfaction that you've done something painful and come out the other side, and you feel like you've grown as a person. And he really kind of tapped into that, I think, in a way that a lot of other people didn't realize.
There is something, whether it's biological or whether it's learned, masculine about that desire to self-improvement through suffering, conquest, whether it's like waging a war or like unclogging a drain or like bench pressing or whatever it is. Like, there is something, there's a correlation between that and masculinity.
The hero story, right? Like, you have to go through some trial and tribulation. That's going to be difficult. It's going to be painful.
Yeah, not taking the path of least resistance, like breaking free of like those constraints and coming out the other side. Like, you've grown.
But as you said, Matt, like, that is good advice, right? Like, I think all three of us would say that the most growing we ever did as men came from the difficult experiences and the mistakes and learning from them. And I think that that is a message, like the accountability side of it is something that we should 100% be doing. But a question I've got is like, how did we get to a place where Manosphere influencers became the authorities that noticed this like gap in the market to tell people that actually, you know, not everything's going to be easy and you're going to have to do some hard work if you're going to grow? What happened to like modern culture itself vacillating that enabled them to be able to do that?
I think there's like blind spots in the culture. So the first chapter of my book, I talk about how back in like 2005, 2006, I got into like pickup artistry because I was like at college, I was super shy, very kind of introverted, lived in the countryside, spent too much time in the house smoking weed, kind of my social skills atrophied, was what's called a neat. I guess I was kind of a neat. So not in education, training.
Or employment.
In anything, yeah.
You're an enemy of the state.
Yeah, long dry spell. Every kind of bad box to tick.
But that does mess up your mind as a teenage boy, right?
Yeah, but I think not as much as today, though. Because at the time, I could have that ego protection where I could say, well, you know, if I wanted a girlfriend, I could bullshit myself. If I wanted a girlfriend. Whereas now, you have this low bar, you can go on a dating app, fuck, 50 rejections. And it's like, that can really hit your self-esteem more, I think. But I got into the pickup stuff because it was like, I kind of thought, oh, I can just overlook this weird, like, misogynistic, manipulative stuff. Because there was like this core of it, which is like, if you just put yourself out there, if you go out on like a Friday night and speak to five people, you're over time, if you do this every week, your social skills will improve. And I did it. And that was true. It actually did work. And it becomes really addictive then, that kind of self-improvement stuff. And you start to treat these people sometimes as gurus because it's like, well, if the culture's been lying to me about this thing that, you know, oh, you'll just meet someone one day, it'll just happen, or fate will take care of it, or, you know, it's all about just being good looking or not, or like you've either got it or you haven't. Whereas they were like, it was this more honest, brutal kind of thing that you just have to put yourself through the fire and you can improve your social skills. Obviously, over time, I realized that there was all this kind of toxic messaging came with that.
Yeah. So you're saying like there's a cultural blind spot, right? Where like there is never going to be like teachers in schools telling you like how to go and pick up girls. Yeah, so there's going to be some market for it, or there's going to be someone who's going to go into that space.
It wasn't even picking up girls. It was just improving my social skills. Becoming not so like locked in so that I could go out. And like masculinity to me now is like being comfortable in your own skin.
Yes.
That is kind of where you kind of reach, I think, partly when you get older anyway. But like at the time, it was like, how do I, like, I feel like I have this personality under all these layers of like stuff that I've put over from just shit that happened when I was a kid. Yeah. And when I put myself out there, it was like, it kind of, you become less afraid to express yourself. And it felt like they were the only people who were really being honest about that I needed to actually put myself out there more. Yeah. Everyone else was just like, tries to be kind or, oh, it'll just sort itself out in the end, or like, yeah.
And there's always been men who feel they aren't getting laid enough, and there have always been men who put themselves forward as a solution to that and usually offer some form of seminar, book, or course to try and solve that problem. What's different about the Manosphere is, A, the social media just, like, pours kerosene on it, but also it's sort of become politicized. So it's not just, I want to read the book, The Game, to learn how to get laid. It's like, I am owed sex from these women and I've been denied it by feminism and I like need to take it back. You know, of course, the main reason you shouldn't follow these influencers is because it's immoral and it's horrible and you shouldn't dream of them. But if your goal is to get laid, the main thing that's going to stop women liking you is if you're following Andrew Tate. Yesterday, I was cycling through Victoria Park and I saw a guy by himself listening to a Manosphere podcast, like on a JBL speaker, like at full volume.
Oh, that was me.
James, you've got to stop doing that, bro.
Yeah, you ruined my
secret. Scaring away the girls.
But like, he was there and it was like full volume. And it was like, some guy was being like, women, I could hear the guy being like, women want what other women want. And then the other guy on the podcast was like, dude, whoa, that's so deep. And like,
that guy's going through psychosis, right?
I know.
Like, what's going on there?
I wanted to go up to him and just be like, listen, women aren't going to like you. They will like you a lot less if you follow this stuff. But anyway, that myth prevails.
Put it through your headphones as well, my guy.
Exactly. Yeah, put it through your headphones. But the all of the men I met at the Warham, I'm sure it was the same on your boot camp, they were men who were not like social, they weren't outgoing socially. They were yeah, quite shy, a little bit of self-loathing going on. They didn't believe in themselves. And their sexual jealousy of other men, of women and of other men, their jealousy of other men was so heightened by Instagram and also by porn, but just this idea that other men are getting it more than I am, other men are better than I am. And part of that is, of course, the 90-10 myth, which is this idea that like 10% of men have 90% of the sex, yeah. Right? Which is a myth that comes from a misunderstanding of the data on dating apps. But when you speaking about, you know, getting rejected on an app like 50 times, that feeds into this idea that like, I'm one of the beta males. I'm not getting the sex that the other men are. They have it and I'm a have not, right? And that jealousy, which again, all men feel at some point in their life, right? Especially in school when you're younger, and especially when people are lying about how much sex they're having, right? The people like Andrew Tate, they don't say, oh, no, that's ridiculous. Like, just be yourself, it's fine. They say, no, that is happening. We are all having way more sex than you. You are a virgin, you are a loser, and you're never gonna have sex unless you buy my course.
Yeah, exactly.
This is it, right?
So that's the sales funnel of the whole thing.
Of course, because anxiety and like what you wanna project onto the world is how we buy things, that's why we consume things.
But they blame feminism rather than say, these masculinity entrepreneurs for that. So this is something that kind of I noticed in the book. So through the journey from like the pickup artist originally from, like the Manosphere is like a 30, 40 year thing. Originally, you'd have these guys who were trying to mold themselves into the ideal that they think women want. Whereas the Manosphere nowadays is much more molding themselves to the male gaze, basically,
yes.
In terms of like what they to impress other men. And that was a huge difference. And they blamed feminism for the way the market was making them feel. So, you speak to any like young woman, and they'll say, or even older women, because it's been going on for a long time, that you know there's this whole industry that makes them feel like shit to then sell them cosmetic products, procedures, whatever. And that market has expanded to men now. So you have boys being made to feel like bad if they're not taking, if they don't have a body that looks like you've been taking anabolic steroids, basically. Yes. All of the movies.
Bigorexia is going through the roof, right?
Like yeah, it's massively increasing. Look at the lead males in a lot of like action films now. The bodies are completely changed.
They're all on PEDs though. This is what pisses me off about that stuff. Though. Is that they go, no one tells you that they're going to be taking loads of steroids, doing some course like 13, 14 hour exercise days on top of it to get to a jacked place for that film.
And people do this. Yeah. Not everyone's doing this. Like not the whole culture isn't doing this. But then the terrain is very kind of favorable for these entrepreneurs to then come along and say, well, yeah, maybe you are a piece of shit. Maybe you are like a soy boy. But if you, like you say, if you buy my course, you can be one of the 10%, one of the 20%. You can be the alpha male or whatever. And they say it's because of feminism. They feel like that. Where it's not because of that. It's because these entrepreneurs, it's kind of a self-perpetuating thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, on that anxiety point, and I think this is something that often gets missed, like, and I'm sure you guys talk about it all the time whenever you're doing an interview, but like, obviously, like if these young men were in a socialized environment where they had a strong network of friends, etc., they wouldn't be seeking this out. Yeah. You know, it just wouldn't happen, like, if they were comfortable.
I really want someone to do, like, a statistical analysis of men who play team sports versus, like, ones who don't.
Solo gaming.
Yeah, because... The Manosphere and people like Tate and stuff, they actually don't take the man who's at home in his basement and is all alone and teach him how to be social and have a network. They encourage the individualism and they say it is a dog-eat-dog world. Other men are competitors, actually. And of course, they say you should do a combat sport. And I'm not knocking combat sports. Oh, they're amazing sports and it's great to get into them. But like they would never say like go join a football team or whatever, which would actually teach you how to interact with other men, how to socialize and all that.
Give you a safety net, etc. Yeah.
When to play as a team, like when, you know, it's not great to be dominant, trying to be dominant all the time. You'll ruin your life. It's like
exactly.
Sometimes you need to be, there is kind of a hierarchy where you're near the bottom and that's necessary sometimes.
But you must have heard together as part
exactly.
of the team.
Yeah.
Like,
you must have heard from Tate fans who've like reached out to you and said like, this guy ruined my life and you know, I followed all of this stuff and everyone stopped talking to me and...
Yeah, I've heard from a lot of people I hear from a lot of men who are in it. Like a lot of them come up to me on the street and it's kind of creepy because I can tell instantly when they're a Tate fan because of the way they look and the way they act and they come up to me. They always have like this very intense posture because that's what they're taught and they speak in very short, terse sentences. Yeah, stare straight in the eye because that's what men do. And they like speak
so
short
robotic,
sentences.
Bro.
Yeah, I'm like, if I was a woman and you came up to me like that, I would be terrified. Like, you know, like this is not how you get friends or anything. But or then the handshake. Oh my
it's
god,
it's very
like,
salesy, isn't it?
It's very salesy. But then with the handshake, when they like crush your hand, you're just like, no, that's weird, dude. I'm not sitting here thinking, wow, he's the alpha. I'm sitting here thinking you're weird. But anyway, they're in the middle of it, and they really want to debate it and stuff. But I also, I have had men who have come out the other end. Lots of men, and they all say the same thing. They say it was essentially they got a girlfriend. Like, as basic as it sounds, like once you are in a relationship with a woman and you kind of learn what that's like, and it's kind of impossible, or it's much harder to not see women as equals, as human beings, you know, and you start to have like nice emotions like love and companionship. And then you're like, oh wait, life isn't just like a competition for like the resource of females. They are other human beings, and a relationship is a real thing. And I think a similar thing happens in the workplace, right? Like once you get a job, it tends to kind of level out, right? Because you can't walk around your office like treating all the women as though they're like second-class citizens who should be, you know, at home and shouldn't be in that office. So you necessarily, it evens out as you grow up.
Yeah, she doesn't leave you just because you show some emotion.
No.
Like,
No.
But then again,
in fact, chicks love that.
But there's also kind of, I have met people who've ruined relationships because they were kind of following what, I don't know, like alpha male, something called alpha male dating systems or whatever, told them to do.
Not Pavlovian conditioning.
Maybe that is an actual program, I don't know. But
yeah,
these men who kind of follow these red pill like dictums or whatever and then screw up their relationship because, the woman just like, fuck this. I'm not putting up with this.
But this is what's odd though, isn't it? Because, you know, what they're teaching is like controlled punishment and reward, right? So it's like, it's Pavlovian conditioning. It's what people like, this like old psychology stuff. It's abusive. It's not about anything that's like for a proper functioning relationship. So you get, I imagine as well, some people, because they've entered an abusive relationship and are seeing the outcomes they want or perceive that they think is like worthwhile, doubling down on it as well. Like as many stories as there are in the good vein of like, okay, you've messed up your life, now you can reassess. There's probably some going on as well where people are seeing these really negative consequences and it's reinforcing them within the Tate mindset, within the manosphere.
Track damaged people though. That's the thing with I'd meet these guys in the pickup scene who stayed in it. So I was like in it really briefly 2006 and then disappeared and then went back for the book. And I'd meet these guys who had still been in it all of this time. And a lot of them were really, really angry and bitter. And there was a whole like complexity to that. But some of it was also because the sample of people they were meeting, they were projecting these behaviors and they'd attract certain types of people in the same way that, you know, if you just go around flashing money all the time, you'll attract certain
people
kind of people
about money.
Who
only
care about that and want that from you. And they sometimes attract like damaged people, and their sample of humanity would be completely skewed of men and women. They'd go around just this very Machiavellian view of the world, trying to kind of use relationships just like for value, gaining value.
Yeah.
And that would kind of screw up their view of women. Like all women are like this. And it's like, no, it's just the ones you tend to be like drawing in and then having these very toxic relationships.
Exactly. And if you were going to go about like learning manipulative Machiavellian tactics to manipulate women into sex, you are going to, it may work for a time, for a short time on, very vulnerable women. Young women who are vulnerable in the sense that we're all kind of a little bit naive when we're younger. And a lot of the women that are targeted by people in these communities are very young, too young to kind of really know what's going on.
They do that by intention though.
They do
it
intentionally.
Yeah.
Women who come from poorer countries. I mean, why did the Tates move to Romania? That is the country with the highest proportion of women in poverty in any European country. So if you're flashing around Rolexes and cars, you know, obviously that's going to,
do you know what that's reminded me of is that we both interviewed Eli, who worked for the Tates.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So this guy is like, he's like the archetypal.
So, okay. So this guy, he was like the head of marketing for Andrew Tate. And he like kind of, he another guy who left the Manosphere because he got a girlfriend and realized that if you just be yourself and like women are human beings, then everything's fine. But the funny thing about him was like, he had only like a raw meat diet because he thought that that would like help him get women. So he like,
I didn't know about this, so you were going, but yeah.
He would eat in a day, like raw beef mince, not like steaks, like mince, like, you know, like raw. and oysters, and he wouldn't drink water. He would only wash it down with like unpasteurized
milk. And he didn't
milk.
Brush his teeth.
So the guy stank.
Women love that.
Bro, yeah, he's got, he had gingivitis, bro. Did you notice? He had gingivitis when you interviewed him.
It was way progressed beyond gingivitis. Yeah. Okay, this guy, he also didn't brush his teeth because he thought that, like, I don't know, brushing teeth was a conspiracy to make you like gay or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. But he, so the guy was drinking raw milk, oysters, and beef mince, yeah. and not brushing his teeth, and following Andrew Tate's cult. And he's like, I don't understand why women don't like me. It's like, dude, brush your fucking teeth.
But that also the halitosis.
But that's a perfect.
The constipation.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a perfect example of the type of person who can be frauded by this system, like by all these schemes. Like, they are deeply, deeply impressionable around certain things, and they have no sorts. Appeals to authority are just like not considered knowledge. It's like, that's, if anything, a sign that you should like subvert it. I mean, the reason I brought him up was because I felt that that was somebody who really encapsulated where the kind of pipeline to like these like war room type mega fans come from. That was somebody who hadn't been socialized properly, who didn't have like a comfortable network of support, who really didn't understand, I don't think, himself, and just wanted companionship, like wanted to be seen. And, you know, I
join
felt really
join
bad.
A football team, like you said, like some of these men, it's like they want like their tribe or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's like one of the best things I did again in recent years was rejoin a football team, start playing football again. Because I just met a whole bunch of new friends. Yeah, it's just, you feel part of some kind of collective again.
100%.
Yeah.
There's an element of credulity to some of those people where they just get sucked into that stuff to a ridiculous degree and treat what someone's saying as just like gospel, everything.
Yeah. What you said about it being a big reaction to feminism, so I did like feminism's gone too far, I think actually does underscore a lot of why the Manosphere's moved in the way it has. Insofar as I think men realized that some of the relative privileges that they had around their behavior, how they could act towards women, have changed in the last 10, 15 years. And there is a sense of pushback to that, because giving up some form of relative privilege, even if you're not able to articulate that and be able to like put your finger on it, but feeling as if the environment has changed, is something that they just don't want to give up.
They only feel that because that's what they've been told by people like Tate. Like, how does a 14-year-old boy know, like, how easily he could have sexually harassed women in the 80s and like the Madman era? Like, they don't know any, they're young, so they don't have anything to compare it to. Like, yes, it is harder now to get away with sexual assault because of the Me Too movement. The idea that like feminism has gone too far, I still haven't seen.
But I think what's going on there is like, and this is a good thing, I want to be really clear, that like young men are getting more education now around problematic behavior as a teenager. But what they're hearing is that their behavior or being a young man is inherently problematized, is inherently difficult or whatever. And so as a result, they're going, you're treating me as if I'm like a prospective criminal. I'm going to go turn to the person who says, you know, you're not that. Actually, you've got loads of shit that's going on in your life that makes you feel anxious. Why don't they care about that? Instead, they're just talking about how bad you're going to be.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's the main reason necessarily. I think that can be something that's quite effective on social media, where you can point at these, especially in the 2010s, you could point at these, like with Twitter or something, the version of your political opposites that you see is often the worst version. So you have people in the Manosphere would say, the feminism they would hold up and in front of their kind of acolytes would be, oh, look at these women on Twitter saying kill all men. Yeah, it's like most feminists don't think that. And it's like, even those people saying that don't think, it's just social media kind of rewards the very narcissistic kind
exactly.
of
everything's
type of personality.
So everyone's chasing shadows. All these, you know, extremist caricatures that people are taking as presentative of the actual thing. I mean, this is like an obviously...
Like the left, like you see people at these Manosphere things saying the left just wants to trans all of your kids. Like I've been at these conferences where they say that, and it's like, that's obviously absurd. But then they'll pull up some social media of someone satirically saying that or something.
I assume we're all men who identify as feminists. You know, if you were asked a question in an interview, you know, I would say I am a feminist. But, you know, when I say that, I know that there's going to be like some Manosphere adjacent person watching this show going, ha, like he admitted it. He is a soy boy who doesn't even believe in the plight of his own people, sort of thing.
It does take courage, especially as a young man, to say I am a feminist, because you will get made fun of for that. You will get bullied. But the thing is, feminism just means you think people should be equal. Yeah. And like what they think feminism means is that women should be in charge of men.
Women are better than men.
So how have we got to that? How have we got to the, you know...
That's the reactionary zeal that I'm talking about. I think that if you like, men who are clearly very insecure will position it and talk about it as if it is that, because that means they are giving up some of their power.
It's also easier to, so there is a recalibration men are having to go through in terms of their status relative to women. Especially like men, I say, like I'm 42, my age and a bit older, a bit younger, where that identity of being like the provider, protector is not what it was. And, you know, that's good. That's a good thing. The women in the home, women are not like helpers and servants anymore. You know, you're expected as a man, rightly so, to do your fair share. Like at home, it shouldn't be like the woman comes home from work and has to start like clock on for another shift in the home. And also there's a lot of this has coincided since 2008 with this big kind of crisis of neoliberalism, for want of a better cliche, where you have like young guys, not necessarily young guys anymore, still living with their parents in their 30s and 40s. Well, that's not conducive to necessarily conducive to a relationship, is it?
Yeah.
You have men who have an education sometimes, who aren't in the role they necessarily hoped they would end up in by that point in their life. And then you have these hucksters come along and say, well, that's because of, you know, it's because women and minorities are hoarding all of the treasure. That's why your life hasn't turned out as you think it should be. And you see this all the time.
Taking your jobs.
Yeah, women are taking the jobs. You can't get a relationship because women are all just pursuing these like high status guys. And you also see similar conversations with, you know, we need to protect women from like migrants, like Andrew Tate. You know, white men need to protect their women and all this stuff. Trump has said that. I'm the protector of women from Mexican hordes or whatever.
Fucking irony of that man saying shit like that. I mean, that's probably like the biggest pretense. And I think a lot of women, when they watch this stuff, going, you pretend, you know, sometimes you cosplay as if you care about protecting women, when more often than not, these people are facing allegations of sexual impropriety. You know, someone like Scott Galloway, for instance, will make the point that young men who are going into the world of work, for instance, are now getting outcompeted by young women, right? So the statistics hold this up. So they're getting educationally outperformed. And I just think that this is an interesting point to think about, where if you are a young man and you feel that society puts your self-esteem, you know, index linked to how much money that you make, you know, that's something that we feel is like an imperative. If you're then in a position where you are getting outcompeted into the jobs market, where you're going to be getting paid well, etc., that you're going to be seen as somebody who is economically strong, you know, what does that do then to your ability to have a relationship and stuff like that?
I think that the Scott Galloway-ification of this argument is misleading. I think I do think that the idea that the workplace is more is that women are succeeding more than men in the workplace is completely false.
It's younger women though. It's not about, I don't think he's making a point.
But it when you adjust it for like economic status, I actually don't think those statistics hold up.
Okay, right.
And I also think that, okay, women are outperforming men in education, in to a small degree in college education. However, that is not translating to them earning more. So that actually proves that sexism is still alive and well, rather than just resist. I think Scott Galloway and people like that, they're trying to jump on that because the narrative that seems to be arising is young men are economically disadvantaged and they're clawing it back through the manosphere. And the cringest thing about Scott Galloway is that he clearly is trying to set himself up as like an alternative to Andrew Tate. Yeah. And he's saying things like, he actually said this, he says, as a man, you should try and make money. You should walk into any room and you should see other men. You should think about whether you could eat them alive, kill them, or outrun them. And you should be out there trying to have sex, okay? Scott Galloway clearly thinks that he's some sort of like liberal Andrew Tate alternative, but he's doing the exact same thing that Tate and all people are doing, which is trying to project how cool and masculine they are and actually being really cringe.
Yeah. I don't doubt that at the...
Sorry, I have a little bit of a gripe with Scott Galloway. Right.
Go on.
And
why?
A slight how tangent. Come? Well, that was it.
That was the main... Oh, I thought something personal would happen on top. No. I mean, if it was on the Andrew main. He called you a DNG.
I like Scott Galloway. Yeah. I like him. But I just think him trying to position himself as like the solution to... And this idea as well that men are disadvantaged, I think we need to stop with that because like all groups in society are economically disadvantaged to the same degree. For example, we always hear the mental health crisis, right?
Young men commit suicide more than young women.
Mental health crisis is affecting women too. In fact, in this country, statistically, more women than men. Self-harm affects more women than men. Working class jobs have disappeared more for women than they have for men. It's across the board, economic disadvantage is happening. Right. And this hypocrisy as well within the manosphere of like, men are providers and protectors, and that's what we should be. But also, like, and we should be stoic and that's our job, but also we're whining about our like disadvantaged position in society. It's just a complete hypocrisy. I think I don't really buy this idea that men are on the back foot.
Yeah, no, I think when it's framed as, it's always bad if when it's framed in like a zero sum way with this conversation. I mean, I've heard Richard Reeves say this, and I think he makes a very good point, is you can talk about these challenges which are more specific to men sometimes, just as there are challenges more specific to women sometimes, and it doesn't need to be framed in this zero sum way where, you know, this bad thing is happening more to men because they're under the boot of feminism or some nonsense like that. So an example would be deindustrialization. Yeah. There's my last book looked at some of these working class communities where you have a loss of male status that was there in working class communities in the past. Status around, a breadwinner status, a provider status, where you're seen as kind of, especially in coal mining, coal miners were seen as like the aristocracy of the working class or whatever. Whereas you go to some of those communities today and it's like the main employer is like an Amazon warehouse where there's no self-respect, no dignity. You're treated like a robot. And there isn't that sense of working class dignity. And so there is a readjustment that men in those communities are often having to go through. But it's not, they're not losing anything because women have entered. It's not because women entered the workplace. It's because you have multinational companies like Amazon can get away with this because there's no trade union in the places or whatever. And you lost some of the institutional affiliations that went along with those old working class jobs. There is, I definitely think sometimes there's issues specific to women or men. So, for example, childcare. Women are penalised when they have a kid. They may sometimes earn, in certain jobs, parity with men in their 20s, but as soon as they have a kid, that drops way off and it hugely damages their career.
Yeah.
And then we still have just 2 weeks of paternity leave in this country because it's still those really rigid gender roles that if someone has a kid, it seems, well, the woman has the maternal role, she should be looking after it. Yeah. So the guy doesn't spend any time with this kid. And you never hear these guys talking about this stuff. It's all just about this superficial
in a maximalist, men versus women. You know, macro picture, when you zoom out, I'm absolutely agree. It's like we still have many more relative privileges and our society is still built up in that way. And you can call that patriarchal, you know, you can whisper that word if you want to. But I do think it's interesting that they do zero in on places where there are, as you've pointed out, James, these inconsistencies or where it seems that men are losing out, right? So if you talk specifically about educational attainment, working class white men, if you had like there was data that was released the other day, which was looking like a breakdown of ethnicity, boys versus girls and educational attainment. Working class white men were on free school meals, the lowest level of attainment. And we know this, like if we zoom out and talk about politics, right? Like Trump's base, you know, the populist right base is specifically going after these disaffected, deindustrialized communities where your prospects are lower than ever, right? And I think it's interesting that they are able to zero in on those pieces of data and those bits of information, harness, make those people feel grievances, which, by the way, it's kind of fair to feel that way. You know, I think it's completely legitimate to feel left behind in those circumstances. And what the problem we have is that the dominant left discourse becomes something like, you know, you're a man, you've got male privilege. And these people are hearing the word privilege and they're going, what privilege do I have? I don't have agency over my life. My community's been left behind. This is a place where sometimes we get a little bit lost as a movement about how to frame and talk about these discussions, because of course we don't want to be, you know, blind to someone else's struggle and their difficulties. But it's difficult. And like, that's where, like, for me, like the Scott Galloway stuff, like I still kind of like, I have a lot of affinity for Scott Galloway for talking about that educational stuff, because my experience of like young guys in general is that they do feel like they're being outperformed. And I am worried about working class men.
But so what is the statistical difference between working class men and working class women, or men, boys who are on free lunches and women who are on free lunches? How big is the gap in terms of overall lifetime earnings? That's what I would want to ask.
Yeah.
I think this is like what
which is a really important question.
Life is becoming harder for people who are in a lower economic strata across the board. And pointing at the small differences between men, women, or even racial small differences are not as helpful, I think, as focusing on the overall hierarchical differences that we're talking about here.
Yeah, I'd say it's worse than that sometimes, because they're channeling the anger, the genuine anger that's felt, the fact we're being screwed over by capitalists, basically.
Yeah.
Channeling it to find other people that, oh no, it's actually not, it's not actually not your landlord or whatever. It's that why the housing situation is screwed. I mean, it's not just that, but it's, you know, it's these women or it's these ethnic minorities or whatever it is. I think that's really toxic. It can be.
People need someone to blame, right? Like there's a, when you have a grievance, I mean, radicalization always says that it's like an us versus them mentality. And so the Manosphere people choose these radical feminists as this thing to go after.
Someone, they have someone, gives offer someone to blame and then someone to follow, which is them if you buy their course.
Yeah. But also a lot of these young men would never be content with a working class job when we're talking about people who follow Andrew Tate, because they want to be like the equivalent of a
top dog.
Yeah, an apex predator. And that is another, that's a cultural issue that is exacerbated through social media, which is like, whatever your job is, it's not good enough unless you're like rich and on the top. And that just, not everyone can be rich basically. But you're told on Instagram that is both possible and necessary as a man.
In fact, you actually see that. You see everyone is just rich and you're like, how is everyone rich and where am I?
I've seen the writer John Gantz call it the kind of universalization of pauperization with social media. So everyone feels like they're kind of falling behind. Yeah. I mean, often working class people are now, but you even have kind of people like Elon Musk who just like motivated by this sense of resentment that he's not part, like he's the richest guy in the world, but he's not part of the cultural elite. There's different elite hierarchies. He's not part of this one. Mm. You see like so much of the discourse now driven by this deep sense of resentment. Mm. And populism of whether it's in the Manosphere like Andrew Tate or Trump, it's almost like everything's corrupt, but it's this cynicism. Everything is corrupt, but you know, I've got mine and I'm going to help you to get yours.
Yeah, it's a dog eat dog world. Yeah. So eat as many dogs as possible.
Trample over everyone to get to the top.
I've kind of given you a little bit of a thesis about why I think the left are kind of losing a bit with young men, but do you guys have, is there something that I'm missing here about why we're not able to win over enough guys and the right have been more effective?
Again, I do think that has been exaggerated a bit. So like when we talk about the increased gender gap in politics that's happening across the Western world, also in places like South Korea, it is that women are becoming more progressive.
Women are moving further to the left.
Women are moving further to the left. Also, there's a slight uptick in young men, say, who would vote for reform or for Trump, in young men specifically. But also, if you look at the past, 20 presidential elections, there has always been a gender gap. More women have always voted for Democrats. More men have always voted Republican. Similar in the UK. And yes, it's growing as women become more progressive. And there is a slight uptick in young men who would vote for reform. And we can talk about that. But I do just think that it has been...
It's been over-egged. I mean, I saw the data on South Korea. Okay, like
South Korea is an outlier.
But you are right in terms of it is young women moving further to the left. But then the analysis I would give is that then left politics follows them, right? So like the overarching like narratives follows these young women or follows the movement, the direction of culture, and that's what they talk about. And so then you vacate some ground, which might be actually in the center, as opposed to being like on the right, which is where those young men still are. And that's where they're getting swallowed up into like Trump last year, for instance. Because it was every male voter group last year did vote for Trump, right? Even Hispanic men were, I mean, I'm sure they regret it now.
But that, there has always been, there would have, there's always
you're
been...
You're saying that's not an outlier from historic...
Exactly. But I would also say that young people in general, women and men, are becoming increasingly hugely disenfranchised with politics. And actually, if you were to, say, assemble parliament today based on what young people would have voted, then both the Greens and Reform would have a huge increase.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know enough about the sophology of the American electorate of before, the last, 20 years or something. But there has been a slight shift here because there's if only women had been able to vote in the 20th century when they got the vote until I think the 90s, there would have been just Tory governments. So there was women in Britain at least that used to vote more heavily for the Tories. I don't know about the United States, although I recognize what you said about Trump did tend to win over with men. I think some of that is, and you do see a slight swing among men, older men with less education typically, towards reform now. But you could easily say that the issue with that is the bigger question, the bigger split is education or age rather than gender. I do think sometimes Richard Reeves made a good point about the last election with Trump in that the Democrats had a better policy platform for men, for men and women, for working class men in particular, but they hardly talked about it. Whereas Trump had a much worse platform for working class men, but his platform was very kind of male coded, to use a kind of Americanism. There is sometimes an impression, and I think it's wrong, that everyone on the left thinks if you're a man, you basically won the lottery by being born like a white guy or something. You know, you read The Guardian and it's like, you're toxic because you can do a bench press or something. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but there's been
but
stuff,
like that was, I mean...
But not, I'm not exaggerating loads.
Yeah.
There has been a bit of that. And it's just like, if you're someone who comes from a place where... Like the Joe Rogan podcast, I used to listen to that like 2016. I used to listen to that bit. Yeah. And it's there's a thing where someone can be more relatable because they like do thing cultural things that you like weightlifting. Yeah, I think that can be powerful. Whereas there's a lack of those kind of figures sometimes. I know it's a cliche now, like the left, the liberal Joe Rogan. You can't force it, but there is sometimes lack of those kind of relatable figures for a working class guy on the left sometimes.
But what does the political left mean to you anymore? Like, is it even an obvious category?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it means like social democracy, socialism, democratic socialism, the idea that we work better as a society, as a collective, than just like pursuing our own individualism all the time. Universalism, that everyone's equal, that everyone kind of is a human being who deserves respect, dignity, a good life, home, place to live. And it shouldn't be just ruined by like people profiteering.
Social equality, prioritizing disadvantaged groups and making sure that everyone is equal. And I think that can sometimes is perceived by some young men who have been spending way too much time on Instagram as running counter to like whatever masculine ideal they feel they should be following, which is one of self-interest and individualism. And the COVID pandemic, I think a lot of young men saw that as, wait, so you're saying like we all have to shut down all of society. I can't go out and like play sports. I can't go out and get a job to protect like basically like the weak and vulnerable people in society, the frail and the older people. And, you know, that to me seems like it's emasculating, you know, and Andrew Tate said that. He said that, you know, he himself knows that the COVID pandemic drove a lot of men to him, you know, because you're basically in his words, it's like, I can't go out and like get laid and be a man because of a cold. And it's true, like for young men, the COVID did not pose much of a danger, right? And you can kind of see them seeing that as an emasculation. And I think, is it Taylor Lorenz on the left who still wears a mask? And you know, this whole idea of like, we still are living through this pandemic, guys. It's like, it's you know, there's disabled people out there and like they could die if we don't, you know. I think that very much is something that a lot of young men don't like, this idea of like you're kind of caging me to protect weak people, like and it's almost like man up and like let's just deal with this
withering away in the house during the pandemic. Yeah. I know it was really awful, like it was really hard. Yeah, some people loved like scolding. There was this whole like discourse of people just like getting off and just scolding people for doing stuff, which kind of you're chafing against that a bit more as well, I think.
Yeah, there's a genre of person who like lives for being like being allowed to scold people. You know, like when you're on the escalator of the tube and like someone's standing on the left when they should be walking, and you have those people who they go like, you know, they love that.
You know, there's a psychological study on that. You release dopamine in your brain when you tell somebody off for like not doing the right social rules.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, it feels good because it's like you're the out person. I'm complying.
Right.
So like even in like high compliance societies, like in like East Asia or whatever, there's like a mental rush that you get out of that. Like this is feeding us as social beings.
Right. So COVID was like a goldmine for those people.
But that's when cancel culture also like kind of went through the roof, the right? Jackpot. It was during like that period of who is in and who is out. And you had young men, I guess, in a space of where I'm deciding who I am, and I don't want to be constrained. I want to be able to decide.
We hate that. Like generally, men and lots of women too, and not all men, but lots of men hate that.
Yeah.
And what we're kind of narrowing in on is when it gets to like the politics of the cultural left, the culture wars. I think that does not resonate with young men. They don't like being told can't do that.
Yeah,
like,
you can't think this. You can't think that. Yeah, I think it's interesting, the polarization question about how that then transfers to relationships, right? So let's say if we're talking in big numbers, you've got young women moving to the left, young men to the center, maybe some reactionary push to the right. The data's still yet to bear that out. But like, how do they have relationships with each other if they have very distinct worldviews? I mean, on one sense, you might say that, you know, when these people come eventually to like get into long-term relationships, maybe that's going to bring people back together and find some things in common. Or are they even going to be in a position to actually break bread together, go on a date, or do you know what I mean, or whatever?
Relationships are the antidote, like you said. Relationships are kind of the antidote to this stuff. Like, get off your but also the loss of public spaces, the gradual loss of these places that you can just go and socialize. The cost of living crisis, where, you know, people don't have the money to actually go out and socialize in a bar or something.
£7 a pint, bro.
Yeah, those loss of those like institutions, where it can even be like the church or something, or those institutional affiliations that people had around certain old working class jobs that don't exist anymore, those community hubs.
The working man's club.
We're more and more like online, more and more encouraged to be online through these kind of silos of like a catalogue, basically. And they want you to, they're incentivized to keep you online all the time.
I also think that the social media thing as well, because any action that you have in your life socially essentially gets mapped now, like, onto the online sphere. We have each other on socials, da 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 da. That's had an effect where people are just having like less relationships, right? Because there's less spontaneity. Everything's given a sense of like, well, this will map to who I am. You will know who, like, we have a place to go from here. I just think that that's like, maybe that's the reason why as generations we're having less sex now than ever before.
Yeah, because it doesn't map directly onto online. So if you look at like Tinder or something, it's like a catalog of flesh. And this idea of like presenting yourself as a brand, like something that is true across social media. And you have like, say Tinder, you have, you're supposed to kind of distill what you want in a partner into like three or four things. Like, you know, there's like, I don't know, it's been a long time since I've been on the apps, like a height filter. There's things like other things like income and just like photogenic. Whereas in real life, it's way more, and people transpose that when they're on the internet, they transpose that to real life and say, well, you know, I don't meet these like very narrow criteria that the apps have created, therefore I'm never going to meet someone. Whereas in real life, we all know that it's like way more, you can't distill like the chemistry you have with another person or the attraction you feel for them. You can't distill that into like three or four very arbitrary kind of points.
I think it's really interesting to think about this in terms of anorexia. And in the 2000s and the 90s, in the 2010s, we were all, as a society, very worried about the effect magazines and stuff were having on women and how it led them to be, you know, anorexic. And the same thing is happening to men now, almost more so. It's more conceptual now. It's not just how your body looks, but it's how you're, you know, how much money you have, like all the other kind of signifiers of being an alpha male and et cetera. But the irony of that is, of course, in anorexia, you are not making your body look better, right? You're making it look worse. You're making it less desirable. In the same way, these men are not making themselves more desirable to women at all. Yeah. Women don't like, even if we're talking about the body, the giant ripped dudes. They hate that. They don't like, they don't care. They don't care if you're like 6'5". Women are actually statistically way less shallow than men, right?
So we suck.
Yeah, exactly. So all of the advice they're getting is actually making them like less appealing to women, and but also less socially capable, less capable of succeeding in life. It's the worst possible advice. They're getting it all on social media, and it's fucking with their brains.
Can I be honest with my two masculinity dads in this room? So I kind of thought that, looking at like Hassan Abbey and stuff like that, that like I'm probably gonna have to get really jacked for this podcast at some point. Like, I'm just gonna have to like hit gym bare, like get on the creatine. Just like I do think that there will be like, I want to exercise more anyway, just for like my mental health, but like I do think that there would be an uptick in my views long term if I did get bigger, because I do think that like, despite making all of the cases that you've made, it's not for dating purposes. My girlfriend actually said to me that if she'd seen my like Hinge profile, she wouldn't have swiped right on me. So like, and we've been together for 3 years. So do you know what I mean? Like, but it's a thing about like, in an attention economy, I guess, where you've got such limited like time, I want to hit the right notes mentally that some young person who's watching this show would just go, oh, I know what that is, like straight away. And I think that's why Hassan Abbey does stuff like that, is because he's aping a little bit of what the other side do, just to be hitting those kind of aesthetic notes that sing for like social media and stuff like that.
I mean, we do live in a much more lookist society now. Like, I think that's like, not, I don't really think that's up for debate. I think like, even if in like the music industry, you think if you just came like down from a different planet and watched the music or whatever, you think that there was some correlation between like aesthetic, like beauty and musical talent, where there isn't. It's just because it's a whole package. Companies want the whole package. Like we've said about movies, the Christopher Reeve of Superman when I was a kid now just looks like a puny, like, soy boy compared to, like, Chris Hemsworth in terms of how, like, jacked he is. There is kind of an interest in some ways in making us feel insecure, I suppose. And we're a much more visual society as well. It's much more through screens. There's been this loss of institutional trust from, like, you know, the financial crisis, the Iraq war, COVID as well. And so you're trying to pass all this information. And a really quick way our brains do it is kind of look for the person who seems to have the most, like, social status. So the person who online who has the most, like, tributes with, like, likes and follows and shares and stuff. And then you end up listening to that person on, you know, you may like Jordan Peterson for his morning routine or something and, like, how to make your bed or whatever. But maybe that's not, just because he has a lot of big following, maybe you shouldn't listen to him on, like, the COVID vaccine and stuff. Yeah. But this is the problem. We're listening to influencers now rather than some of those old institutions, which...
Institutional distrust is a massive problem.
There's so much information.
You have to pass it. And you go the same way. Why do you buy the Coca-Cola over the, like, Tesco own brand Coca-Cola? Because it has the social proof, partly. It's like, well, all these other people like it, so I'm just gonna... It's like a quick... Saves your brain, like, having to, like, decide. And with all the information, it's like... There's a tendency to follow the person who has the most clout, and that's not a very necessarily a very good way to do it.
Yeah. Do you think I shouldn't try and get jacked? You look bigger, by the way, since, like, you did your Tate, your, like, Tate stuff. Have you been hitting gym?
I had a baby, so, like, I'm just at home a lot, and so I have, like, a home gym, so it's kind of like all I do now.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, like, no, I think that you wouldn't. I think compared to, like, being, like, for example, funnier or more likable or just, like, more, like, you know.
Is there a gym for that?
There's not a gym for that, unfortunately. Unfortunately.
I really think that,
like, I don't think other men really care. You're right to point out that Hassan Abi became hench. Okay, yeah, that is true. But he already was pretty famous from, like, gaming.
Yeah, and, Twitch streaming stuff. Yeah.
And also is, like, objectively a very good-looking man.
Dude's,
and, like,
fucking handsome, bro.
Yeah, so... That definitely makes him more popular with women. I don't know if him being jacked has made him more popular with men. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, look, tell me in the comments if I need to do it. If I don't, I would much rather have the time back. So, you know. I think one of the other things that we haven't covered today, which is kind of like a big elephant, is like porn use and, like, how that's affecting, like, young men. I sometimes think that it's almost more... Maybe not more, let's not get to Olympics over it, but it's, like, it's just as corrosive as the manosphere in some ways, I think, but the addiction to it. And when I look at stuff like Bonnie Blue, Lily Phillips, and all of that stuff that's blown up on over the last, like, year, I just think they've taken the Andrew Tate playbook of, like, say the shocking thing, do the thing that is going to make people go, what the fuck? Like, what the hell is that? And market yourself as a result of that, because you're going to get unlimited attention and unlimited clicks. Like, they are gaming the algorithms by pushing their body to the limit in the same way that, like, Steve-O did on Jackass, you know? They're, like, doing it in a way that's, like, so mental that everyone's just like, whoa, like, I didn't know someone would ever be capable of doing that. But obviously, they've got something that they want to sell at the end of the day. And I'm sure it's making them loads and loads and loads of money.
Michael Sartain, who's, like, one of the pickup... Well, he's, like... kind of status maxer kind of guy who ran the Men of Action program, who I spent time with in the book. He did say something which was kind of right, which was that status is status. So, like, you see now, and it's been like that for a while, it's not just social media. I mean, the big brotherification of, like, TV, where people are just kind of making a fool of themselves because then you get just to get more famous. Whereas, like, you have people who just become famous and then buy something, like, embarrassing, or but they're still around, like, 20 years later, still kind of making a living from, like, the Jackass guys are still newsworthy from that stuff. So I think we live in this attention economy, not to make, like, too trite a point, where doing extreme stuff kind of can cut through that information, like, vortex sometimes, and those people can then have a career off the back of it because it's better than working in, like, a call center or something.
Yeah. And also, what's weird about the society we live in right now, what's really weird and unique in history, I think, is that those people, the shock jocks, people doing the most shocking stuff, are somehow becoming, like, politically important. Like, there's always Jackass. There's people like Jade Goody on Big Brother. But, like, nowadays, like, Steve-O from Jackass will probably become president of the U.S., right? Like, you know.
But as a Dem, though.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's weird because, yeah, like, you had... The people who got attention through extreme stuff on reality television. Donald Trump was one of those people. He became famous for going on The Apprentice and saying you're fired. Yeah. It's just that he now has become president. Andrew Tate, like, okay, yeah, like a misogynist, like giant guy, like going around with like a bunch of women and flashy cars, like, he's like, oh, that's funny, I'll follow it. But it's like, no, he seems to now become a political movement. Now, even like, is it Lily Phillips, Bonnie Blue,
and well, Lily Phillips. Well acted.
I was in the queue with
one. I thought I recognized you. More Jack than you. Yeah, exactly.
They also weirdly have become somehow politicized, like it's about feminism somehow or whatever, or it's feminism has gone too far and it's resulted in them. They have nothing to do with feminism at all. So like it's really, really weird. There's also another thing going on. Have you guys heard of the phenomenon of audience capture before?
Yeah.
So, okay. What's so that? Audience capture is the idea that like you can be radicalized by your audience. So the classic example is that guy, Nico Avocado. So Nico Avocado started as a vegan influencer, but no one watched his things. And then he said like, I'm going to eat a burger. And everyone loved that. And they're like, do it again. He started doing more and more like, I'll eat loads of meat stuff until he eventually became morbidly obese to the point of almost dying. And he's like, and it became famous through that. So his audience said, we like the extreme shit, keep doing that, and almost killed him through doing that. Andrew Tate is kind of like that. He's kind of become morbidly obese, but his morbid obesity is kind of like misogyny and extreme stuff. Yeah. Trump is the same. You know, he discovered on reality television that the more intense and angry and obnoxious he was, the more the ratings went up.
Yeah.
And something happened in that process between the camera and the producer and the real Donald Trump, if such a thing even exists. Something in the middle became the performed version of Donald Trump. And that is the person who is now president. And like a lot of people ask me with Andrew Tate, like, is he actually like that? And I don't really know if that question even applies anymore. Now that we do so much of everything for social media, everything is a projection, everything is photographed, everything is filmed. It's almost like the performance is more real than the reality. You know, there is no genuine self.
I feel this like just doing the podcast itself, like since we started, it's like, who's going to be you in front of the camera? Like, are you going to play up to this thing and be like, this larger than life character? Or am I going to be exactly the same person when this thing is rolling and not rolling? Right. And I think the incentive structure of social media itself is pushing me in a direction, as I said earlier, where I'm going to get jacked or whatever, but pushes you to a point where you want to satisfy what the audience wants. But the whole point of this thing is to be like, actually, people need to just be honest about what they think about the world. It's not playing up to, you know, what everyone else wants to hear.
Yeah, I mean, in a world where like everyone's expected to perform all the time, people invariably become like caricatures.
Yeah.
So when you see like the game show host president, I mean, it does seem a bit like that. Like we're more and more expected to perform as part of our like personal brand or whatever. Like I've written a book, and even the last book I wrote was a few years ago. It was like came out 2018, and the things I'm expected to do now, in terms of, that sounds like weird or something, but the things I'm expected to like
drink
perform much
blood
more.
Blood of orphans or what are you up to?
That's next week. it's much more, the role is much more performing for like video, short form video than it was before. Whereas before it was like reviews or more, like it was extracts this time, but it's much more this performance, which that's changed quite a lot. And it's infotainment, Neil Postman's book, everything is becoming infotainment, basically
dumbed down as well. And by the way, just I don't think we've gone in enough on social media yet.
So I about that. Don't worry, that's on my list. We're about to get into it.
Okay, can I
give now, you a spiel? Give me a spiel.
Basically, like social media can, a lot of the blame for all the things we're talking about can be laid at the feet of social media. As you said, like the more controversial, the more extreme, the more the algorithms favor your content. That's how it works. They are profiting from this, right? I mean, it recently came out that Facebook, that Meta, like found out when young girls would delete selfies of themselves and then like market them beauty products, right? They would target advertising. That shit is happening to all of us every day. It's not just people like Andrew Tate in the Manosphere. It's like when I go on social media, I'm often, have you guys ever seen this thing? Like, what metabolism are you? Are you a wolf, a lion, or like a fox or whatever? And it's like, do this workout plan, like buy this supplement. Like maybe you have ADHD and like get this, you know, maybe you have like this. And it's just, you're being marketed at constantly by different wellness things. They're all trying to like solve whatever problem it is that you have. And they're profiting off it. It's almost entirely unregulated social media. And a lot of these problems will go away if we grow some balls and actually like do our job as a society and regulate it.
Go back on the pornography points, kind of skipped over it a bit. I mean, it's hard to know. Like, I've seen like mixed evidence in terms of like, does pornography cause misogyny or more misogyny, or do people gravitate to that kind of pornography because they're misogynist? But I think what is in some ways more interesting is how pornography, in this similar way to social media, how it shapes the view of other people. So, like 15% of people on the internet pay for pornography, something like 14-15%, whereas most people just consume like free pornography. But the market is skewed towards the people who pay for it, because the companies, when they put out their pornography, they want to attract the 15% that pay for the pornography for obvious reasons to make money. But those people who pay for it tend to have much more extreme tastes than the 85% who just kind of casual users, as it were. So what that means is porn is very much skewed towards those extreme tastes. So you're much more likely to encounter videos where like men are kind of strangling women or something, and women are much more likely to encounter that as well. And what it can do is then men and women can come away from that and think, well, this is what women want, or women can think, oh, this is what men want in the bedroom, because like this porn seems to be everywhere, this seems to be what men are consuming. So the market basically distorts what we think the other people are basically into, in the same way that, or in a similar way to how social media distorts what we think our kind of political opponents want to do to society.
Yeah, and I think that's
really interesting, I think.
I think the education that most teenage boys go through, sexual education, is watching that extreme stuff.
Right. Now, probably when I was a kid, it used to be like find the porn magazine in the bush. Right. But that doesn't happen anymore.
No,
like,
it doesn't. It's way more. It's like
that's
way
been
more
phased
accessible.
Out. Yeah, that innocent era has been phased of like the Razzle magazine in the bush. It's been like phased out.
I don't know what like, that is.
But, young bucks.
Do we think that before porn, sex was this like beautiful intimate thing, always where the woman always orgasmed? I mean, ask your grandma what sex was like in the past. I'm sure it wasn't. Yeah. I mean, maybe
that's a crazy social experiment.
Ask grandma that.
I'm not doing that. But carry on.
But I don't think she would say like, yeah, it was all like very egalitarian and like men never did anything violent, etc., etc., etc. We don't really like. I don't know if we ever had anything. I think men always have had the propensity for like
violent sex,
yeah. And I think that.
But what you've got then is a changing of the ecosystem, the information ecosystem, where that thing has become more normalized, right? Because it's become more readily available. I mean, there's interesting data, James, that you said, like you've seen different data. Like I heard from one of my friends who does a lot of research in the incel space, Maeve Park. She's written a great book. That she was telling me that it's actually liberal men tend to be the biggest audience for like the more extreme transgressive porn. And one assumes that those liberal men who are, you know, feminists and et cetera, aren't
The ones you have to watch.
Yeah, be careful about them, man. But it's like, that's quite revealing in some ways, right? It's like telling us that, you know, let's say super liberal guys are more likely to like bend rules or challenge norms or stereotypes or whatever. And maybe like that's where it's coalescing. I'm not saying it's a one track fits all answer, but I do think that there's something's happened where people's, you know, understanding of this space sexually has changed, and their threshold for what they might describe as something like that's too far, it's just been lowered because they're exposed to more stuff.
Yeah, I don't want to flog a dead horse with the point about, I think a distorted idea of what other people's expectations are. And I've encountered that myself, yeah. And I've also just heard this from people like, which also can cause, I think, performance anxiety in men as well. So they think that they've got to be this kind of stallion in the bedroom going for like 3 hours or something. Whereas most women like are not expecting that, you know? Maybe, you know, don't put in too many poor performances. But but at the same time, like there's a happy medium, let's say.
Yeah.
He's speechless.
You're thinking about some poor performances.
Well, you've all been there.
We've all been there.
And it's fine.
We've all been there.
Whoa, guys.
You've never been there?
Never, no.
Your DNG pass has been revoked.
No, I just think like, I think you're probably right. I think like, again, it's men who haven't had relationships. Like the way you learn to be good at sex is by like having a relationship, obviously. Yes.
And listening to your partner and yeah.
Yeah, and she's probably not going to, in most cases, unless it's an unhealthy relationship, she's probably not going to stay with you if you're like, just, you know, if you're not good, if you're trying to do what you see in porn constantly. So I reckon that, like, again, that's another thing that probably evens out as you get older. And when you're still young and you like don't have, you know, your idea of sex is different. It's not based on like things that have actually happened. Then it may be more heightened.
But one of the things that, like, you guys must get this as well, like, social media feeds are quite like soft pornified, right? Like, they're just, you just get fed it as a guy, like, very quickly. And I think it's like one of the first things, if you ever set up like an Instagram or TikTok account, you'll be fed some form of soft porn in like the first 10 reels, right? And if you're a hetero guy, you're probably gonna look at the titties, like, you probably are, right? And so then you just get fed more and more and more. And like that over sexualization stuff, again, it's just feeding into the attention economy things, is that like our brains are, can be primed in this way, like, just instantaneously. Like, we live in a world here where parliamentarians are getting in trouble for watching porn in the chamber. Do you know what I mean? Like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you know, 50-year-old stupid dude, like, bro, like, come on, like, get real. But at the same time, as you said, it's a bit of a thing of these platforms themselves are kind of revealing to ourselves our worst impulses, and we're just like straight up buying into it.
Yeah, and I think it's also messing with the reward pathways in the brain, and a lot of this stuff has to do with dopamine. And you know, they've done studies on mice where they've taken a mouse and a male mouse, they've introduced that male mouse to like just one
loads of mouse porn.
Yeah, loads of
furries porn.
Weirdly, mice like furry porn somehow. If you introduce a male mouse to one female mouse partner, it can stay hard, basically. It can remain levels of arousal to the same degree every time it has sex. Whereas if you introduce like a shitload of female mice partners to it, then each time it is aroused, it is to a lesser degree. And that is like when men can't get it up because they watch too much porn, that's kind of what's happening, is their dopamine pathway, they're getting less dopamine each time from sex because it's been leveled out too much. Exactly the same thing is happening with every other thing that dopamine is meant to do in life. In like the things that the reward pathway of the brain, the thing that get you excited, whether that's like sports or like your hobbies or just like traveling or having sex or whatever it is, hang out with your friends, you're getting less dopamine, but a constant drip of it from Instagram. And so that messes up with your reward pathways. And the way to solve that is, it isn't just like less Instagram or whatever. It's, you got to also do other things. You have to make sure that you're always getting like real dopamine experience.
We've definitely got dopamine addiction as a society. I mean, like, we're addicted to our phones. Our phones, the content's releasing dopamine. Something like, we've talked about the more extreme elements of this to like some of the more basic stuff of like comedic videos or whatever that you're on a doom scroll on. But like, one thing that I don't think we've got into yet, which is a big part of this whole space, is conspiracy theories and people getting a rise out of just like the algorithms, firstly, like promoting them because there are these like crazy narratives, they're like incredible stories and people are getting a rise out of them. But that being so destructive then on our like information.
Between like 2006, when I first kind of got into the Manosphere stuff, some of the Manosphere stuff myself, and then like today, it became over time much more political, as we've talked about, but also much more conspiratorial. And some of that was because they already, many of these guys bought into a conspiracy theory that women ran the world. But then when you buy into one conspiracy theory, you often have to square the circle by like bringing in another conspiracy theory. Because if women run the world, like, how can women simultaneously be like hysterical, stupid, but they also run the world? Like, how does that kind of work? And so you saw some of these guys, Tate specifically, Dan Bilzerian, other people in the kind of red pill space at some of these conferences I went to. Yeah, just like embracing anti-Semitism, because they would straight up say that, well, they would say the Jays. They would say Jewish people, basically, women are marionettes and like Jewish people are behind the scenes, like controlling things, and then kind of go further. And often they'd swim in like a right-wing ecosystem where those ready-made conspiracy theories were already there.
Tate obviously lives for conspiracy theories. It's like the jet fuel that goes behind a lot of the stuff that he does and says, constantly telling his audience that, you know, it's everything that's happening in this court case is not happening, even though he's still facing those allegations. Does that drive you a little bit insane, just having to constantly bat away just nonsense stuff when it gets tweeted at you?
Yeah, actually, I mean, it does. It kind of, because... Like, for example, when we did our documentary, we interviewed women who alleged that he kind of, that he sexually assaulted or physically assaulted them. One of these women, Andrew Tate, actually te- texted them saying, I loved raping you. And, you know, Andrew Tate denies all these allegations, and we included that as well. But if you were to look at just X, you would get the impression that my documentary had been totally debunked, that the women were paid actresses. And that's a theory that, like, oftentimes when an Andrew Tate fan comes up to me, whether it's like an Uber driver or whoever, they're like, oh yeah, like it sucks what happened to you. You did that documentary and it got completely disproven, kind of thing. I'm like, it got completely disproven. That is what you think. Andrew Tate generally and Manosphere influencers generally don't just spread misogyny. They undermine trust in all sorts of institutions, the media, democratic institutions, law, the justice system, reality itself. You know, Andrew Tate refers to it as lawfare. In the US, they refer to it as, Trump refers to it as judicial activism. This idea that, like, all of the cases brought against them are somehow, like, yeah, they're fallacious claims, and that the justice system doesn't actually pursue justice, right? That's what, that benefits Tate, it benefits Trump, it benefits a lot of people in his cabinet, because they've all, a lot of them have been accused of sexual assault. But yeah, it's undermining trust in the fabric of society itself, and promoting conspiratorial ideas.
Where they're the authorities and they control the information ecosystem, exactly. Right? It's purposely powerful, power giving to them.
It's micro cults, basically.
Yeah,
it's
like literally. Cults.
They discredit other sources of authority, family, institutions, and then come along and present themselves exactly. Like the authority you should follow, and more importantly, pay or vote for.
And what I always tell people, Andrew Tate fans, is like, okay, Andrew Tate's saying you should not trust anyone and question everyone who says to you. I'm like, yeah, okay, that's actually a good point, but why do you not apply that to Andrew Tate himself? Because he's the one manipulating.
The last episode we filmed was with a disinformation expert, it looks like online manipulation, and we were looking at how KGB active measures was like one of the ways in which these tactics were really like excavated during the end of the Cold War. How much of this divisive rhetoric that we see online is just getting pumped into us by like foreign actors? Do you think that that's like a plausible theory about what's happening right now? Because it seems to me like it's completely possible.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is. I mean, we live in such a crazy world right now. Russia right now is funding influencers to radicalize and confuse American, British, European young people. That is happening right now. They're putting tons and tons of money into it. They did this as well in, you know, the 60s. They funded a lot of the anti-war movements and like other radical groups across the US. It definitely is the type of thing that they do, but they're not the sole generators of the crazy, insane people on social media.
Catalysts. You
know, the sole catalysts of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like capitalist technology. That process is kind of bigger than that. We're kind of swept along with it in a way, like riding the tiger of it. So there's kind of this big process of this, the technological advancement and the way that this is wedded to these capitalist companies, which have an interest in just keeping us online all the time to then sell advertising revenue. That's kind of, I say that's more of the issue than like these specific like malevolent states, although that, not saying that isn't an issue, but I just think we're all kind of being swept along in this kind of vortex of the way social media is.
But that's the
profit driven social media.
It's the sickening paradox of it is that we, you know, in some ways we choose to live in this world that's like constantly making us
more
anxious.
I say we feel compelled. It's like a compulsive thing, isn't it? Looking at the phone.
Yeah. But the threat's coming from within. Like Elon Musk has done more to spread disinformation in the US and volatility
in the world
than Russia has, and Mark Zuckerberg. And in the Cold War, the American government believed that they didn't have to do much, didn't have to invade the Soviet Union because its internal contradictions would cause its own collapse. I think that's what Russia's thinking right now about the US and Europe, is they don't need to do much because we are destroying ourselves from within.
Kind of makes us realize like how crucial this moment is right now. Like at what point are people going to start taking levels of responsibility and coalescing to create movements for collective bargaining through like union politics? Do you know what I mean? To say onto our governments, actually, we need to regulate this thing. If this thing can be used, I'm talking about social media here, as a weapon against ourselves, maybe we should find a way to not be pulling the trigger.
Kind of breaking away from the kind of infotainment ecosystem on an individual level is something that we can all try and do. I feel like it can literally like ruin your life in some ways if you're just compelled to, whether it's pornography, gaming, just this like slop. Just this
isolated this slop, isn't
fucking
it?
Endless torrent of like slop. And it's like, I'm not saying this in a like supercilious way. Like, I get sucked into that as much as anyone else.
Yeah.
And it's just like hours just drift by and you realize you're just kind of, you're not, it's like a compulsive behavior, you know? It's like an addiction, basically.
And we all get the same deep anxiety afterwards when you're like, my whole day went away from me because I was doing this thing that is intangible and I don't even appreciate or value. Yeah. I also think on the Russia point as well, you know, there's been this like nice alignment between these, like between the Russian state itself and these actors in America who want to be pro-Russian now because they're worried about China and they're trying to do this Kissinger thing of like decoupling China and Russia and trying to win them over. And like, we're seeing that play out in Ukraine. It's like such an odd inflection point though, from all of the, you know, priced in understandings we had around foreign policy about who was our enemy, about who was in our interest and what the values that we stood up for and cared about are. We're just getting more exposed that the only thing that matters about our system is protecting like multinational corporate interest.
I think the perfect example of what you're talking about is what happened in Romania recently. So, you know, in Romania, the counter to what Russia does in terms of disinformation is that the US historically has funded through USAID things like journalism and, you know, jurisprudence and democracy in a legitimate way in Eastern Europe to prevent like Russia from spreading its tendrils and corrupting society in that way. Donald Trump and Musk have gotten rid of all that, have gotten rid of all the funding for all these. A lot of the journalists in Eastern Europe who report on corruption, who report on Russia's influence, who are reporting on Andrew Tate, were trained as journalists under programs that were funded by USAID. In Romania, the Russians influenced the election using TikTok, and then the Romanian courts disallowed that election for that reason. And then J.D. Vance came over and said, no, that was messed up. You should have let that guy win. So yeah, you do have this weird alignment now where there's like the disinformation agents in Russia, the US government, the current administration, Tucker Carlson, and it's all like an axis of disinformation. It's very weird. We live in the weirdest time in history right now, I think.
And no wonder people are so fucking confused. Do you know what I mean? No wonder people are so discombobulated. Like everything by design is teaching them and pushing them into like these weird holes of information.
And you have among those groups. So like Trump's kind of an old style imperialist who respects Putin because he thinks, you know, Putin should have his sphere of influence in Europe. Mm-hmm. And then Trump thinks he should have basically dominate like Canada, his sphere of influence, Latin America, the Panama Canal, Greenland even. And you have around him people like J.D. Vance, who essentially, like, what was his Munich speech? You know, J.D. Vance is someone who basically hates his own society and sees the West as like decadent and fallen. Mm. And it's a mistaken belief because Putin doesn't really represent traditional values. He's, you know, more corrupt than any Western leader. Russian society
is the world.
Kleptocracy. Mm. But there's certain things, the way in his presentation again, he presents himself as like this hierarchical leader, the man who's always on top, you know, whether it's the shirtless horseback photos or more seriously, more consequentially, you know, decriminalizing domestic violence in Russia. So mm-hmm. Russian men, you know, he says to Russian men, you know, I may not give you anything but poverty and war, but in your home, you're a feudal lord. You're an oligarch in your home. And that's kind of that status thing that has often been patriarchy has kind of been given as a status thing to low status men to say, you know, you may not have much, but you can kind of dominate your family at least. And you see that guy, Coach Red Pill, died in a Ukrainian prison of pneumonia because he went over this Red Pill guy to be a Chilean American guy. I forgot his name now. It's a while ago to pump out Putinist propaganda because they see, you know, women in the West is like, we live in a gynocentric society and stuff, whereas Putin, that more traditional society, even Jordan Peterson is pondered whether Vladimir Putin may be on the right side in the war against wokeness. That's how rot the deep is.
Do you think Vance wants that? Like,
not the exact model, but people like him and his outriders like Sohrab Ahmari, who's like a theocrat, right-wing theocrat, they think that liberalism is just like failed and we need to have this, not the Putinist model, but we need to go back to kind of this kind of almost like Francoist kind of model where socially conservative, where people kind of know their place and stuff. Yeah. And the world is run by these big empires with their own spheres of influence where they can do whatever the hell they like.
Power is power sort of thing, isn't it?
I mean, the might is right.
Yeah, might is right.
Survival of the fittest. And you can see how that's attractive to people like Tate and some of these influencers.
And I think this is the question then, is like how we, with this small microcosm of influence that we all have, like, disrupt and change the value system of, like, our society? If we're all in agreement here that, like, things are moving in the wrong direction, you know, the question I always get asked is, like, what is, like, positive masculinity, quote unquote? And I just think the big thing is, like, we just need better role models, right? We just need better bigger brothers. Like, we need people who are going to hold other men to account and encourage them to, you know, self-actualize, but in a way that means that they're more empathetic, that they take responsibility for their actions and so forth. You know, how do we create better role models?
It's a big question.
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah, like everything.
It's sort of an impossible question.
Yeah.
I do get asked this a lot, like, how do we create better role models? Obviously, Scott Galloway is gunning for that. But, like, I don't think you can, like, as a society, create better role models. I know Labour toyed with the idea of, like, funding influencers in schools, and I think that no one's going to...
No, because it's artificial. It's not real.
No, instantly cringe.
Instantly cringe, yeah. I think there probably are, have always been the same amount of, like, good male role models out there. I mean, like, I think a lot of the England football team are good role models. I think there are good male role models. The problem is they were not afforded the same platform. They're not afforded instant access to every child's phone in the world.
Yeah.
That's what social media has done. Like, so it's more just we need to, like, delete the attention we're giving the shitty male role models, and the other ones will fill the gap.
Male role models can be really important. So I grew up with a dad who was present. You hear conservatives talk a lot about, oh, fatherlessness is a problem. Well, maybe if he was present, it would have been worse, because it's better to have an absent father than an abusive one, or just someone who's like a piece of shit or something. But I had a very inspiring male teacher in my college who believed in me and was like, yeah, you should go to university and stuff. And I was at a point in my life where I needed that, and it really inspired me. And then I did really well because of that in my studies, because it was like, well, this person actually, I'm going to adopt this identity that he's kind of imposing on me a bit, that I can, you know, I can be like, go the academic route and stuff. Yeah. There's like fewer and fewer male school teachers now. So I think that can be something.
I think that's a problem.
I think that can be a problem. I don't necessarily know how to explain why, but sometimes I think as a young boy, it's good to have that dynamic. It's good to have kind of the male figure is a bit more scary sometimes, that, like, even though they're never going to do that, there's like this like implicit threat that they could like be violent or something. I don't know if it's that or just like I've always felt I'm a bit more afraid of those kind of male authority figures. But at the same time, I think role model discourses like these, like influencer role models. I mean, Andrew Tate's like a role model. I don't think we want to teach people to just uncritically follow people off the internet or uncritically follow the influencers. Maybe on one issue, but I mean, it's almost like teaching critical thinking.
And by the way, it's not just, I feel bad for going after Scott Galloway. I really do think he's...
I think he's a force for good.
I like him. I apologize. But there is a tendency amongst people on the left to be like, hey, maybe I could be this like left-wing Andrew Tate, Joe Rogan guy. And it's so cringe. And you see it with like Newsom as well. He starts being like, you know, talking about like
so California
going against
man.
Trans stuff, like going on Charlie, like having Charlie Kirk on his podcast, like trying to bro out and stuff. It just doesn't work. Like, and that's when you talk about you getting jacked for the podcast. Anything you try and do to like become a male role model will make you more cringe,
make
right?
Moist.
Get
I'm a soy boy, bro. Through and through. I'm not changing. You can't change me.
get jacked for the love of being jacked if you want to do that.
I want to exercise more for my mental health. Like that, just as a bottom line, like I'm definitely feel better when I'm physically active. And I think that's something that more young guys should be encouraged to do, like, and take pride in that. That's a good thing to be disciplined about.
But that's living, like, that's doing it for yourself and like authentically, rather than just doing it to kind of perform for other people.
Imagine if Keir Starmer starts like doing boxing or starts doing like, they start releasing like Labour like videos on Instagram, and like working out in the gym or something like that. That is where we'll go if we do this male role model conversation.
I'll tell them not to do that.
This is how he can win back the red wall. If he gets a tattoo sleeve and
turkey
teeth.
Yeah, exactly.
And he just sinks a pint in like under 5 seconds, John Prescott style. Okay, people are going to follow the shit that they're interested in. Whoever those people are out there who are, you know, great in music or sports or whatever, it's just about those guys just communicating to their audience that being a good person involves like taking accountability for your actions, like having empathy for other people, not treating people like shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like just getting those guys to subtly show through what they do that that's what matters. Like, that's how you be an upstanding person and contribute to society.
I would like to see more athletes and people who have like male followings speak out about these things. I don't know why so few people in the fighting community and the comments community haven't spoken out about, like, you know, Tate and how he's damaged the sport. You know, I don't like, I, or like if the Democrats had The Rock on side, that, you know, that probably would have solved every problem in America. If The Rock actually just chose to be a little bit like more political, I think like it's fine for political parties to team up with people like that. But I do think that the problem is a lot of athletes, a lot of famous people are very afraid to say, have any sort of political opinion, because they're worried it will lose like sponsorships basically, and they'll lose money.
But I always think about Colin Kaepernick, man, like a man of like such integrity who lost his whole career and life basically, well, like his working life as a result of his principles. Yeah. I think that's what's in their mind. Like, that's why they're not going to, but like, what do we inherit then, right? If everyone like says no to having any sense of like responsibility over our media discourse about like where we're going as a society, we get slop world where people are just going to be gaming it for the sake of making money. And like, I just think we've had enough.
Yeah.
And people like Tate is like, in some ways they represent sort of the suffusion of a certain capitalist logic in to every area of your of life. I think the issue with some of these online influencers now, or at least where that culture is, and like hustle culture and all this stuff, it's just, it's everything's through like an individual prism, and it's all against all, and everything's kind of a shit show, a corrupt shit show.
Mm.
But I'm just going to help you to get yours, just like I've got mine. Like, look at all my stuff, and it's like just being more people speaking about really like prosaic things and being community minded, like in your local area, like localism. The death of local journalism has such an impact on this stuff, I think. Yeah, just local politics has become much more distant, and just like helping fix your local community and stuff, and people coming together to do that. And when you actually come together in person and you're not just like siloed on the internet, I think it does change people's kind of perspective, and the world doesn't seem necessarily like this dark and hostile place all the time.
More communitarian, like
public spaces, yeah. Though you need more public spaces.
We need those spaces back. We need it to be affordable. Yeah. I feel very lucky to be able to like have this conversation with like you guys, you know, and to be able to not just test like my prejudices, but like understanding of this. It's like, I spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff, and to be able to be in a position where I can like throw it to two people who've had even longer to think about it and done more things just feels like incredibly fortunate. I hope that other people out there, other young guys who watch this show, will take this as like an impetus to go to like chat to their mate in work who's like 10, 15 years older about this stuff. I don't know what our age gap is, James. Maybe you're old enough to be my dad. Maybe we are.
Maybe I am.
So yeah, look, I just want to say big thank you for coming on. We're just starting out on our journey, but like, please come back and get involved again.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, it's been great.